Okay, thank you. And thanks everybody for staying awake still. And I hope it will stay that way during my talk, but we'll see. And in this talk, I want to speak about some work we did together with Pilanru and Masiria Botta, and they're both here today, so I hope they will agree what I'm going to say, or maybe spare the comments then for later, for afterwards. And I think I should also maybe give you some little memories about Bill. Of course, I was also very impressed by him when I first met him, but I was also quite astonished when I came to work with him as a postdoc now a few years ago. And one day I was sitting on my desk doing some things. He came in with some little gadget where you put on the keyboard so that can you adjust the height of the keyboard. And he said, oh, I should get up. And then he really went there. It was a really big old wooden desk. And then he installed himself, crawled underneath the desk and installed himself all this stuff, these gadget, everything by himself. And I was really, really sort of very astonished. And for me, in Germany, usually you have the professor who tells the secretary that this should be done, and the secretary then tells the caretaker. And here was this famous, world-famous professor who crawled under my desk and installed everything by himself. I was really sort of, yeah, quite surprised. I really enjoyed it, working with Bill, and still enjoy it. So, you know, come around to doing it. Okay. So now I will talk about these partner particles, mainly for black hole evaporation. But before that, I will speak about some general aspects. And let me put this into some broader context. And these partner particles occur in many situations. And in general, if you speak about some quantum radiation phenomena, and here I'm considering especially relativistic quantum fields. So there will always some H bar and C being important, even though sometimes I set them to one. And these quantum fields start out in their vacuum state over here. And then due to some external conditions, they can end up in a state which is not the vacuum state, or look like it looks like that it's not the vacuum state. And one of these important examples is, of course, Hawking radiation, where the vacuum fluctuations are ripped apart by the strong gravitational field near the horizon. But a very sort of related effect is the Sauter-Schwinger effect over here. Ah, yeah, this is a picture of Hawking, of course. This is a picture of Schwinger, where instead of the gravitational field, you have the electric field. And the electric field, then, if you have a strong electric field in the quantum electrodynamic vacuum, it pulls out electron-positron pairs. Very similar effect. And then here, of course, this is Bill. We have the Unruh effect, or the Unruh radiation, where the gravitational field is sort of replaced by an acceleration. And we also heard from Stephen Fulling, for example, about this dynamical Casimir effect, where here I mainly consider that you have some set of mirrors which are then moving. So the static Casimir effect is if you have two mirrors, they attract each other in vacuum due to vacuum fluctuations. And if you have, say, the mirrors moving, then you can create photons out of the vacuum. And even if you have one mirror and you move it non-inertially, you can also create photons out of the vacuum. And I will consider this example later on. And another possibility for creating particles out of initial vacuum is cosmological particle creation, where actually the expansion of the universe rips apart the vacuum fluctuations and creates particles. And actually, here's a picture of Schrödinger, because Schrödinger already wrote a paper in the 1930s. And he already understood that an expanding universe should give you a mixing of positive and negative frequency and should produce particles. So even before, and I think probably Parker didn't know about it since he didn't cite the paper, but even before Parker, this was sort of understood.
But Schrödinger said it was a breakdown in the theory. He said it was a disaster.
Yeah, but there's also that basically that there should be this, in the paper there is some sense that this expansion of the universe should then entail that their particles are created. That's whether he considered this was strange, but it's in the paper that he understood there should be particle creation. Maybe he didn't like it, but it's in there. And also in all these effects, there's no direct experimental evidence yet, even though maybe for cosmological particle creation you can count the little anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background as sort of signatures of these initial quantum fluctuations, that the seeds for these effects are then produced during inflation according to our present understanding, but it's still not completely direct. So in all these cases, you have these relativistic quantum fields starting off in a vacuum state, and then you create particles. And also in all these cases, people usually say these particles are created in pairs. Now the question is why? Why do we say particles are created in pairs? Oh, sorry. So in one way to understand this is to say, okay, we have a linear field equation. So all these cases are linear field equations in some classical fixed background. And then one way to see that is that you say the initial creation annihilation operators are connected with the final, say, annihilation operator over here by a linear Bogoliubov coefficient, Bogoliubov transformation with Bogoliubov coefficients alpha and beta. K and K prime are some quantum numbers, could be a wave number, for example. And if the theory is linear, also this Bogoliubov transformation is a linear transformation. And you will see that gives us that the particles are created in pairs. Or another way to see this is to say if the field equations are linear, then the Hamiltonian generating these field equations is bilinear form. And if you look at the time evolution operator over here, so time ordering and then exponential over time integral of the Hamiltonian, if this is a bilinear form, then the whole thing is e to the something bilinear. And that also can be understood that in general, this generates some generalizing squeezing operation. So the in vacuum is related to the out vacuum by such a possibly complicated expression. But the main thing here, this is just a bilinear form, and there's a generalized squeezing operation. So you have two creation operators with possibly different quantum numbers. Here are the annihilation operators, and the whole thing that is called generalized squeezing. But this is the most general thing which can happen under these circumstances. And then if this xi here, or equivalent to the beta there, is non-zero, we create particles. So the final operator in the initial vacuum is not zero. And if you make a Taylor expansion here in powers of xi, you see lowest order gives you just the out vacuum. And then the first term here are these two creation operator acting on the out vacuum. So you have two particles. Next term would be four particles and six and so on. So that's why we always say this is we create particles in pairs. But one should be careful. It could be that these two particles here live in totally different asymptotic regions. So that's basically the point to look at. Say, if you take this one, what's then the corresponding partner? So this is the question I want to address here. OK. So and I want to, the goal is to understand Hawking radiation. And let me just remind you of this usual derivation. So here's the typical textbook picture of the collapse of some matter towards a black hole. Time goes up, radius goes to the side, and we assume spherical symmetry. So here the green line is the surface of this collapsing star, which is then here, forms the singularity over there. And these red lines or red curves, these are light rays. And you all know initially the gravitational field is so weak that the light rays are going to basically propagating 45 degrees or far out. It's also 45 degrees, but if you come closer, then the light cone is tilted, and then it's deformed. The light rays are bent. And then you have the situation that here there's one light ray which is just able or just manages to escape to infinity, and then another light ray here is then doesn't make it, but is captured by the strong gravitational field and crashes towards the singularity. And the border between these two light rays here, the blue line, that's just the event horizon over here. Here I'm assuming that it goes on forever, otherwise it would be just an apparent horizon, but let's have this classical picture. And now what Hawking basically did is to say, okay, this is a classical space-time diagram. Now see what does quantum fields do on this background. And because of an initial vacuum state over here, and then calculated what happens up there, and then you see if you look over here, then as you know, it's no longer the vacuum state, but this is a thermal state with this Hawking temperature, which is written here. And then there are some sort of more intuitive picture for this Hawking radiation, and one of them is this with this antiparticle pair, which is sort of in the usual vacuum created and then annihilate further on. But I think this is a bit dangerous. Since you could imagine how should this be for photons, for example, do we have a photon and antiphoton pair which are doing something like this? And the other point is that the mode, which is sort of here falling inside, that doesn't exist on the outside. So this particle antiparticle picture is a bit dangerous. It's a nice picture. And I think in Frankfurt, there was another meeting where George Ellis sort of used this particle-like picture for Hawking radiation to argue that the Hawking radiation should vanish if the black hole is growing slowly. And that's, of course, not quite correct, but I think it shows that these particle-like pictures are quite dangerous if you take them really literally. Another picture is sometimes people say that something tunnels from inside to the outside, but I think that is that's also a bit dangerous to use this picture since A, nothing, yes, it's causally forbidden to go from here to there, even quantum mechanically, and B, what should be if there's something tunneling from here to there, there must be something here to start with, so it's also not, I also didn't quite understand this tunneling picture, so what I'm proposing here is a bit a different picture based on these two harmonic oscillators. So let's consider here, say, two harmonic oscillators like two pendula. And you say if they're just sitting there here, say they're in the ground state, classically they're just hanging around without moving. But you know, quantum mechanically, you have these quantum fluctuations. So this one has a ground state wave function, this one has a ground state wave function. And they are totally separate as long as they don't talk to each other. But now assume we have these two harmonic oscillators with a spring in between, but the spring is totally relaxed. So putting the spring there doesn't change the oscillators. So the classical ground state is the same. They just hang straight down. But you know, the quantum ground state of this system here is now different from this system. Due to the spring, the quantum fluctuations of the two pendula are correlated or entangled. So the ground state of this system is actually an entangled state. So it's no longer a product state like here. And now imagine taking these two harmonic oscillators in the ground state and suddenly remove the spring. So cut it or just remove it. And you do it so fast that the quantum state cannot react to this change. So you still have the same quantum state as before since you suddenly remove the string. So this is this one here. And then you have the situation that you have two separate harmonic oscillators, but the whole state is still an entangled correlated state. And if you do the math, you find that still, let's say the spring is weak, with a high probability both are in the ground state, but with a certain probability, depending on the strength of the string here, this one is in an excited state, but then this guy also must be in an excited state, and so on. So if your second one excited is here the same. And this basically then, that you have two oscillators, and if you just look at one of them, that this looks like a thermal state of one of these oscillators. And that I think is much, much nicer, more fitting picture for the whole process. That it would say here, you basically have these two oscillators, they are very close together, and in the vacuum, they are entangled with the spring. But then, once the horizon comes in, and these two oscillators or these two wave packets are ripped apart, that sort of corresponds to removing the spring over here, and then finally this guy is moving out to infinity. This guy is sort of falling in. And then if you just look at this guy, you would say, oh, look, this is excited state, and it's even a thermal state. And then if you do the calculation, it really gives you this temperature here.
How do they know that
they're going to be filled apart? They don't know. You have here two oscillators which are tangled. You have also here two and here two oscillators. But these two oscillators, they just move out. And the spring is not ripped, is not taken off. I mean, in the vacuum, you have always sort of the picture would be that the vacuum, you always have these vacuum fluctuations, but these vacuum fluctuations here, they happen to be ripped apart. No, these are these two guys. These are these two modes here. Everything happens in the modes which are trying to escape. The modes which move in, they just move in. And, okay, but I think this is a much better picture, but it's still a picture. For example, then you have to look what is this guy precisely and exactly. So now that's what I'm going to talk about. But of course, you also know there are several problems with this Hawking picture here. A is the problem Bill is always sort of pushing or making people aware of. Is if you take the Hawking wave function here, wave packet here, and trace it back in time, then very soon the wavelength is so small, it's far below the Planck scale, and then you wouldn't trust your theory anymore. And the second one, which we already heard from Bob Wald, is this information puzzle, where you see if you believe that the whole thing collapse and evaporation is unitary in our space, not in some other space, then how does the information get out? So it is still...
some historical remark. It's interesting that Zygmunt didn't believe Hawking radiation for half a year or maybe a little bit more until he comes with the idea, picture that you have parametric excitation of exactly this kind of thing.
Oh, I see.
And after this, he...
Oh, okay.
I know well because he submitted the paper, review article, and he kept it for half a year until he...
Oh, okay, I see.
Agreed with Hawking. So it was some kind of... Zygmunt.
Yeah, I knew that, that initially Zeldovich didn't like it or didn't believe it, and then after a while he...
He saw that the static field is kind of created in this kind of manner, but after he realized that if you consider propagation of oscillation, there is a regime when it becomes not adiabatic.
Yeah, that's precisely here. The non-adiabatic is sort of then from here to there.
Each quarter it will take later.
Yeah, this is the scale invariant. So if you have quanta with higher wavelengths, which are closer together, then the same thing will happen, but at a later time. So this is just, you have this scale invariants. Okay, so the question will now be here, what precisely is this one? Or can we, is this, it's still, I mean, you don't have single harmonic oscillators lying around at this black hole, so this is still a picture, so just be careful. For sure. I mean, you can add more oscillators, or you can have more more things coming in or getting out. But this is sort of the minimal picture. Yeah, this is sort of
the first one.
Yeah, two oscillators go in, and two oscillators sort of come out, but initially two oscillators, finally two oscillators. So this is.
Then
will be more. Yes. Okay. So the question is then, if we take now, let's see, we have here, we measure our Hawking particle with some given detector, which says what kind of wave functions we measure here. And the question is, what is then the second guy here, this inner red line? What is the partner for this partner particle? What's the partner of this Hawking particle? And now we have to define what we precisely mean. If I give you a wave packet here, what precisely you mean by this partner? And our approach was the following, that we say, okay, it should be that this Hawking particle here is totally entangled with the partner particle there, but not with any other modes. And that means that if you take now our initial state, the quantum state here, and you trace over all modes except the Hawking mode and the partner mode, then this reduced density matrix of just these two modes should be a pure state, which means there are only correlations between Hawking and partner, but not between Hawking and anything else or between partner and anything else. So just the two are correlated and nothing else. It means that there's only correlations between between the Hawking mode and the partner mode. And that already nails down the partner mode quite a bit, but not uniquely. Oh yeah, and it should also say, of course, if you now say you take this density matrix and also now average over the partner, then of course you get the density matrix for Hawking, which is thermal. So this is mixed state, of course. But the two of them should be a pure state. Now what you could imagine, you could still say, okay, I have my partner particle, but I could still rotate at the partner mode, do some rotations that is not fixed by this requirement. And then we say, okay, from the picture that they come in pairs, we say that the state after annihilating or detecting one Hawking particle over here should be the same up to normalizations due to probabilities, post-selection, and so on, as the state after creating one partner particle. So you say, you have your initial state, you detect the Hawking particle, and if they come in pairs, then there must be the partner particle sort of left over. So you could do the same thing and say, okay, instead of detecting the Hawking particle, I create a partner particle. So that means that they sort of come in pairs. And in the most simple case, we are considering this is symmetric, so you could also do the other way around, detect the partner and create the Hawking particle. So you always have two particles, and if you take one out, then one is left over. And that then turns up to some irrelevant phase. That determines then the partner particle uniquely, these two conditions together. Okay. So just to show you how, I mean, just the formula, but then I will explain you how it looks like in some examples. Okay, so let's see, we have our Hawking mode, so the annihilation operator for our Hawking mode, we also have the creation operator A dagger, and that is related by a Bogoliubov transformation to the initial creation and annihilation operators with some alpha k and beta k. And once you give me these alpha k and beta k, then I have enough to calculate what the partner mode is in terms of these coefficients. Unfortunately, the general expression is a bit messy, and it becomes much, much simpler if we assume that these two coefficients, I mean, this is then sort of alpha k is something like a vector. For each k value, you have one number, and beta k the same. And if we assume that two vectors are orthogonal, like this, then the formulas become much simpler. So I will consider on this case here, but you can do the same thing in the most general case. And if we assume these two vectors here are orthogonal, then we can write down the partner modes quite in a closed form, and that's the expression here. So from these two conditions, we get a unique partner mode for this Hawking mode there, and looks like the following. We first have the hyperbolic cotangent and hyperbolic tangent of some squeezing parameter, which is written here, and that's just the hyperbolic sine of the squeezing parameter is sort of the norm of this beta vector. And then up to these two numbers, what we have here for the partner mode is almost the same as we have here for the Hawking mode, but just complex conjugate. So sort of this guy then goes here, and this guy goes here, and then you have to add these two normalizations. And that then gives you the partner mode, and that is precisely what you want, since then the state of Hawking and partner is a pure state, if you do this. And in this case, it's also very nice, since then you can write the whole thing, rewrite the whole thing in a different way. You could say, if you take our initial vacuum state and just look at these two modes, Hawking and partner, then this looks like a squeeze state. So a squeezing operation acting on a state zero, which is then the state which would be annihilated by these two, by the Hawking and by the partner mode. So in this case, you can really see, the state we have, our initial vacuum state, looks like a squeeze state if we view it from the point of view of these two modes here, and psi is precisely this parameter. So if beta would be zero, all the betas would be zero, psi would be zero, we have no particles, so no squeezing. But if you have particle creation, then there are some squeeze state here. And here you also see all these particles, they always come in pair. You have one Hawking, one partner, or then two Hawking, two partner, and so on. Okay, and the question now, what does this is a bit hard to see what it looks like, so let's consider some example, and that's a moving mirror. And for simplicity, we go to 1+1 dimension. And if you have a moving mirror, it's already enough to consider one of them. So in principle, if you have one moving mirror and you shake it around, then you produce particles like photons. And here we consider a special case where the moving mirror is sort of initially at rest, and then it starts accelerating, and it accelerates forever. And it accelerates in such a way that the local acceleration here becomes stronger and stronger in the same way as the redshift factor becomes bigger and bigger. And this, that's basically given here. So the mirror trajectory looks then like this. If t and x, t minus x are the usual light cone coordinates, then this trajectory of the mirror is precisely the one we are considering. And this is such that this accelerated mirror gives off thermal radiation in this direction. So basically what we have is, initially the mirror is at rest, and then if here's the vacuum mode coming, it's just reflected as vacuum, but then the mirror is accelerating, and then if modes are coming here, they are reflected by an accelerating mirror, so they are sort of turned around and twisted, and that means vacuum coming in is then created into thermal radiation going out. And if you have modes which come in even later, they don't see the mirror at all, since it here becomes asymptotically speed of light. So this is then sort of, this line here in the middle is then like the horizon. So that modes here, they are then reflected, produce the thermal radiation, and modes coming in here, they don't see the mirror at all. And this is also very closely related to a black hole, since you imagine take a black hole, now take a 1+1 dimensional black hole, and the mirror would be a point in this case, so just let the point-like mirror fall into the 1+1 dimensional black hole, then from the outside, it precisely looks like it has this trajectory over here. So you don't, from the outside, you don't see, you really see it fall in, you just see it asymptotic with, asymptotically go to the speed of light. And then from the outside, you could say, okay, I don't see Hawking radiation, I just see my mirror moving away from me, but the mirror is producing then this radiation due to its accelerated motion, and that's basically the same as the Hawking radiation. So it's the same, you get the same temperature over here. Okay. R equals, sorry, what is R equals here? There's another way to say, okay, instead of a mirror falling into the black hole, I could consider some matter which is collapsing, and then the R equals zero is something like a mirror, since waves coming in are reflected, so this has this trajectory. Yeah, that's another. Should be equivalent. But this is really 1+1 dimensional black hole, and you let the mirror drop in, and that gives you also this trajectory.
In this case, your partner is propagating outside of the horizon.
Yeah, that's just what I'm coming to. Okay, so now let's see here. Let's assume we put a detector which is measuring such a Hawking mode here. That's our detector, and the detector should be measuring this wave packet. Then we see, okay, where does this wave packet come from? And you see it was reflected here at the mirror, but during the acceleration, so it's then squeezed, and initially the wave packet looks like this. And then you see from here to there must be a mixing between positive and negative frequency, which was precisely the reason for this particle creation. Oops. And now we can take this guy and ask what's the partner. And if we assume, that's not quite to scale here, so if you assume that our Hawking mode has a reasonably well-defined frequency, so it doesn't look like this, it more looks like this, that we have an envelope, and then here many, many, many oscillations. It was a bit hard to draw this, that's why it looked like this. In this case, the partner mode is basically the mirror image of this Hawking mode here on the other side of the horizon. So if you have the detector mode here, squeezed, then you make the image at this horizon line, and that's then the partner mode. If it doesn't look like this, but more like this, so it is a bit broader, then you also have a little bit of support of the partner mode on the other side, which then looks like this sort of. So there would be, in this case, there would be a little bit of the partner also on this side, but let's assume everything or most of the stuff is on this side. So this would be sort of the partner wave function. And these two together, they are in a pure state. And also these two together are in a pure state. And then you see this partner mode here, that just propagates along here in a region. It doesn't see the mirror at all. So here in this region, the partner mode is locally in a state which is indistinguishable from vacuum. So this state here, if you make any measurements on the modes which propagate in this direction, they haven't seen the mirror at all, any measurements of these modes is the same as in vacuum. So the surprising thing here is this detector mode you detect is entangled with this partner mode over here. And if you make measurements here, they look thermal. If you make measurements here, they look like vacuum, all the correlation functions. But if you look at the correlation between these two, they then tell you, that was in total a pure state. So these Hawking particles here, thermal, are entangled with partner modes, which are basically locally indistinguishable from vacuum fluctuations. If you do any measurement here with these modes, they just look like vacuum. And then in principle, you could also imagine after letting the mirror accelerate for a long time, then here it just stops accelerating and then continues with a constant velocity. And then the partner mode would then be reflected at an inertial mirror. But if you have vacuum coming in and an inertial mirror, then just have vacuum going out. So it would be the same that this detector mode here, thermal state, is entangled with some vacuum modes over there. Yeah?
If they're entangled, then the partner mode has to be fixed, correct?
If you just look at the partner mode itself as a mixed state, yeah, of course, yes.
So then how is it in vacuum?
Yeah, if you have a vacuum and just look at a tiny part of the vacuum, you get a mixed state.
Okay.
That's just, yeah. You have huge vacuum fluctuations, and then if you just look at it, one mode in the vacuum, then you have in general a mixed state. And it's even more crazy if you say you have the state here, and now you annihilate or detect one Hawking mode, then it's the same state as if you would create one partner mode, say, up here. So whether you detect the Hawking mode here, or whether you create, add a partner mode over there, it's the same state. And that's sort of related to, I think, this energy teleportation, that if you would know what's going on here, and you would know the result of the measurement, so Alice makes a measurement here, and tells the result to Bob, then Bob here would be able to extract energy out of the vacuum. Problem is, Alice cannot tell him, since it's sort of causally disconnected, but in principle, that would be a way to get energy out of the vacuum, which is related to Masaryk-Hotta's energy teleportation. But the main thing is, the partner mode is then locally indistinguishable from a vacuum fluctuation.
But after measurement, it becomes a particle?
Which particle?
Sure. After measurement of the Hawking radiation, it becomes a real particle or element of vacuum.
Yeah,
you sitting there, it looks like an element of the vacuum.
So if Bob
so
doesn't know,
correlate with what the guy saw over here, that it's not.
It's not what?
It's not it no vacuum. Longer looks like an element of the vacuum.
So, but it will be particle, on shell particle.
Sure.
If Bob makes very local at high frequency measurements here, we'll get huge fluctuations. And the deflactuation would be just like vacuum. Only if he compares then the measurements with Alice, says, whenever Alice measures this, then I measure this big, so I measure positive energy. But if Alice measures something else, I measure negative energy. So in average, Bob measures zero. But when Alice tells him, there is one, then he could in principle be, I'm sure there is positive energy, and I could get it out.
If we just look at the state, if the mirror becomes inertial,
yeah.
And we look at the state, we don't look at any of the Hawking particles or whatever, but we look at the state of late times, off in the region that would correspond to where these partner particles reflected. Are you saying that one would not be able to distinguish that from the vacuum?
Yeah, also.
State?
Yeah, also. If from here on, say, it then stops accelerating. It goes on with the velocity stops accelerating, and then the later V mode just is reflected by inertial mirror, and then it's just reflected as vacuum going this way. Then of course it will be, if you then compare this mode with the partner mode here, then the partner mode will be redshifted quite a lot.
Right.
But in principle, it's exactly indistinguishable from vacuum. Yeah. Ideal mirror, assuming ideal mirror and so on, of course.
But the vacuum doesn't have that strong an entanglement with other things.
Vacuum is entangled with all kinds of stuff.
There's Maslow's scalar field,
just
so there's.
Talk about entanglement in a vacuum.
Well, this is for massless scalar field, where all the modes do this. If it's a massive field, then things become more complicated, and you don't. But this is for massless scalar field, and then you have this long range entanglement, and that's sort of then where the correlations are hidden in this case.
What's the root of the tail of the partner?
What's
one? The partner has a tail.
That now depends what precisely you whether you make this really with a compact support or not, and then you go back to frequency space. So there's in general will be also some tail, but if you assume that you have a nice Gaussian here with some where the tails fall off fast enough, the partner will be just the mirror image of this guy. This guy will then be squeezed and distorted, but will basically be locally in this region, and the partner then will up to tiny corrections be located in this region. Yeah.
Because I don't quite understand it. For me, it's somehow with the dynamic of cosmic effect and then compared. So what if I would, were to take two mirrors and would then uniformly accelerate? So that the distance between them is always constant.
Ah, yeah, which distance? In which, then there's the issue in which frame the distance is constant and so on. So this is a bit...
But I would suspect nothing is happening.
No, no, still.
But then, I don't know.
I mean, if you're... I'm not sure which you're referring to.
Because if you compare to the dynamical cosmic effect, it's something completely different.
I don't know. I mean, if this is one just an accelerated mirror, I would say that could be called dynamical Casimir effect.
Like a second mirror, yeah. It also accelerates. So if you tell me now, if I have one, I see the summer radiation. If I have two,
No, for two is different. For two mirrors is different.
Ahead as you stand there trying to measure it, and you're not noted. You don't measure anything.
So for two mirrors, it's more difficult.
But I have a flight signal bouncing between.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And
yeah.
I don't know if you're telling me now you cannot measure it. And that's the problem. I'm just saying physically, I don't see what's happening. The distance could stay the same between these two mirrors.
I mean, you have to. The situation depends about what kind of distance stays the same. Versus this distance from the lab frame or from the guy from distance from the co-moving frame. But what was the question? I mean,
I don't understand.
In the co-moving frame, they would not have the same charge if they were saying same distance. Proper frame, they would not have the same
solution. Okay, and we have this is just for one mirror, since this is sort of the closest we get to Hawking radiation. This picture here. Okay, so now let's do the same thing in a black hole. Again, we assume that we have a Hawking mode which looks like this here on the outside. And then, to a very good approximation, also we have this mirror. You take it back, see how it looks like here, and then you have the mirror image here, which is then crashing towards the singularity. And now it's no, for the mirror it was really exactly any local measurement would give you the same as precisely the same as vacuum. Here it's not quite the same, but I would say since the guy falling in trying to distinguish this from a vacuum fluctuation doesn't have enough time since. Crashes to the singularity quite fast, I would say to a very good approximation, they are very almost indistinguishable from vacuum fluctuations. But this is not, in the mirror case, was really exact. Here it's not precise anymore. But it's also, I would say, very hard to distinguish them, these fluctuations from vacuum fluctuations in a black hole. But here's not so precise anymore.
Just pull down the particle from outside. Not enough time inside to measure it.
Yeah.
In this sense, you say that it's not particle but becomes vacuum. It's not very accurate. So you have real
quarters
pointing down inside.
No, I mean, the point is from here to there, there's a much longer time than if just a photon falling in. I mean, from here to here.
It's more difficult to say that photon is particle inside than this one. You have more time here.
You have more time, but the point is the long time you have that is here, and for this long time you have, it's basically the same as vacuum, only for the very latest part when it starts to fall, then you may be able to see something, but the problem is you don't have enough time to really. So I say the point is it's very hard to distinguish this from vacuum fluctuations.
The falling observer in some strange way is not equivalent to somebody very close to the mirror moving with the speed of light and almost and then changing direction. I mean, you can measure first the partner and jump out to measure the radiation. You cannot do the other way around because of the. You can first measure.
You could make a measurement here.
On the right one.
And then do a. Right. Yeah, that.
So
yes, yes. To what? Sorry?
To distinguish between the thermal states in this element.
Okay. If you would measure the correlation between here and there, then you would see, look.
Single observer.
I mean, if the observer is doing this, then in principle that would be possible. So you would first have to measure a very short wavelength measurement. I mean, this is purely outside. Here you only have outside. No, but this is all outside. And if you have sort of observer which is first doing a measurement with very short wavelengths, and then later on with the precise phase doing a long wavelength measurement, you could see in principle these correlations. Yeah. Okay. So. Okay. Now the question is: Does this sort of tell us something about the black hole information puzzle or paradox or what you want to call it? And I mean, Bob Wald already spoke about this. So the main thing is: this is the question is this formation and evaporation unitary? And unitary means in one space where you have the black hole forming and evaporating without baby universes or some other disconnected stuff. And first one should also say all the calculations, they are assuming standard quantum field theory in nice curved space-time, so there's no firewall and no nothing. So this would all, with a firewall, this would all change. But the problem is, if you have a firewall, so that means that you have something strange here and no regularity for, say, an infalling observer, then in principle, I would also say, why should you have Hawking radiation in the first place? Since the reason to believe in Hawking radiation is that the infalling observer doesn't see anything special. Once you have something special at the horizon, then I would say I just take the, for example, Boulware vacuum state, which is the ground state, exact ground state for all the observers outside. And that's perfectly fine. No Hawking radiation, no nothing. But the problem is, if you take this state and hit the horizon, then you get a singularity. But if there's a singularity anyway, then I would say it's okay. And we have solved everything. Black hole is stable. No Hawking radiation. Everything fine. But I mean, the point is sort of it bites its own tail. If you assume a firewall, then you sort of removed one of the main reasons for Hawking radiation in the first place. So here I'm assuming regularity. And what we have is basically correlations between these Hawking particles here and the partners, where the partners are very hard to distinguish from vacuum fluctuations, which are sort of falling towards the singularity. And then I think to address this issue, we have to ask the question if there's a singularity or whatever quantum gravity does at the center, so it could be some inner horizon or something else, what does this singularity or whatever is there do with this infalling vacuum fluctuations? One thing is say, okay, just absorb them or puts them somewhere else and they are gone. So that would be sort of the alternative A. The information is lost from our point of view, from the outside point of view. Or one could say the singularity somehow stores all this information in some way, but then we get the same sort of problems as Bob Wald mentioned with these remnants. So either if you have a very tiny thing storing a lot of entropy, or then if the black hole shrinks, then this sort of contradicts to the black hole entropy, since we're supposed to know that the black hole has what kind of entropy a black hole has. And if the black hole shrinks, the entropy should shrink, but that doesn't work here. And I think what we should probably give up anyway is that clashes with the simple picture that we say in a solid state, we have our Planck scale, and then we have at each Planck scale one space-time point. And that is sort of what the quantum gravity does. That also doesn't quite work. Or if that's not okay, then the other possibility is that the singularity re-emits this information in some way. But then, of course, you sort of get problems with this causal structure here. So there should be some information from here going to there. And then the question is whether you want to have that. I mean, there are some ideas. You could imagine why that should happen. But this is sort of then you have to solve this problem. So our analysis basically doesn't tell us which one is better or maybe not so good. But I think what the analysis tells us is that a simple identification, you have that much entanglement, that much entropy. Therefore, you have to have a lot of energy. That's not quite true. So we have to be really careful with saying so much energy, so much information. That means you have to have so much energy. So this is not quite the case. And maybe just some little simple toy model. The question is, can we have a system where we store a lot of entropy without storing lots of energy in it? I mean, this is very, very naive, so let's just assume very simple toy model that we have, say, we have a large number of independent qubits, and say the vacuum state or the ground state is, say, all the qubits pointing down. Just simple. And then we say, okay, we take this state, but a little bit or with a very small probability, we flip small n, which is much, much smaller than the total number, but much bigger than one. And we flip little n of these bit qubits with some small probability. And then you know, okay, how many probabilities do you have? And that's basically this binomial coefficient, large n over little n. And then the typical energy expectation value in such a state where you have flipped these spins would be probability times the number of states, which are the number of possibilities, and then say say flipping one spin of one qubit costs some energy, and if you flip n spins, then basically energy scales with little n. And then you consider such a state and say, okay, then we have a density matrix. So it's, and we have the very large, very almost one probability we have this state, but with a tiny probability we have one of the other states, but there are many of them since we have many possibilities. And then if you do the math, you see that you can have an entropy over energy expectation value, a ratio like this, which scales with the logarithm of the total number of qubits. And then the question, of course, if you have many, many qubits, you can make this ratio quite large. But let's say in a black hole, in some space-time, spatial region, in some volume, how many qubits can you put there? And then, of course, it's a bit hard. Naively, you would say, okay, let's put one qubit per, Planck length cubed. That would be the most naive thing. But that's probably, I think, too naive, since if you imagine, say, an expanding universe, and you say if you have space-time points, and initially these space-time points or spatial points are one Planck length apart, then the universe expands. So after a while, you have then space points which are quite with a big distance, and that doesn't quite work. So the simple picture is maybe not so good. But then the question is how many of these degrees of freedom you have in a given spatial volume. But I think this is still I don't know what a good answer would be. But the point is, if you have enough of them, then in principle you could encode a lot of entropy with very little energy in there. Which is for this. Well, not. What do you mean by infinite? I mean. No, this would be for the black hole. Let's assume the singularity takes the vacuum fluctuations crashing in and then does something with them and maybe scrambles them and puts them into some very short Planckian wavelength modes. And they maybe, I don't know, their light cone structure is such that they can get out. I don't know. Just let's wave some hands. And the question is how many of these degrees of freedom you have to emit from the black hole to do this? Yeah?
Is in your picture all the spins have the same energy
gap? Yeah, here, yes. Yeah.
Isn't that what catches you at the end? Because if you just look at quantum field theory without a kind of just regular quantum field theory, then in principle there are as many qubits as you want, but at the end, it becomes more and more expensive.
That's true. Yeah. But then you have to say, okay, the lowest mode you can put in some volume is then some one over length or something. And then if you black hole, you know how many information you have to give out per given unit of time. So, yeah, that I think this is sort of the question is in a given spatial volume, how much entropy you can put in there without that it looks like vacuum. I mean, this is still the point. I mean, we don't want that the black hole gives off any strange things, but it should look like vacuum. So, and that's the question. Yeah?
Yeah, I don't know if you're coming to this, but I think that the more decisive argument is that how much entropy can you have inside the black hole? Who knows what's inside?
I mean, no, but the point is you have to, it has to get out. Yeah.
How rapidly can you get it out?
Yeah, sure. That's some space volume which is sort of moving here. The question, how much information you can the black hole emit to this volume which is outside, yeah.
Yeah, and there the energy bound in really, I think that's related to what he was saying. There you can't play with this kind of...
Why, sorry?
Well, because you have to, because outside, we understand what the vacuum is.
Yeah, but you don't understand what the vacuum is at Planck scale distances. You don't know what the vacuum looks like at Planck scale, at very small, small scales. You know, we know. Yeah, the point is here, this looks, is with a probability which is almost one, is basically in the ground state, and only very.
How long yeah. would it take you to, you know, compensate to drive the external entropy associated with the Hawking particle
yeah,
down to zero?
Yeah.
If you had a tiny remnant that was containing almost all the initial entropy of the black hole. And the answer is that it's some absurdly long time. So you'll be left with a remnant that lasts, you know, many universe lifetimes.
The point is here that that's not that I'm not saying that I have a remnant where all this stuff is in there. The question is just if the singularity somehow does something with the stuff and kicks it out again, how much information can you sort of reasonably contain in some, say, given spatial volume?
But you don't and know that, what's inside the black hole. Is
no.
a singularity that is quantum gravity?
Yeah,
you
yeah,
know
no.
What volume is associated
no, no,
with
yeah,
that?
Sure, yeah.
It's completely open.
Yeah, of course. The point is, can it get it out?
Space
yeah.
doesn't
I mean, if the information gets out, then at some point the information must propagate to some through some region which for us looks like flat or almost flat space.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just everything say everything is stored, then okay, also no, there would be option B over there.
But it's not stored. I'm just saying the usual argument is, which I believe is correct, that if it's not stored forever, it still has to be stored for an immensely absurdly long time.
Remember in the whole problem you had this huge amount of entropy in a tiny little region just outside that horizon in the moving mirror model.
Yeah.
Right? So you had all this thermal radiation came out. We now go back and look at the partners. Those partners are squished up into a tiny little region there. They're traveling at the velocity of light. They get out, in other words, they travel off into that left-hand direction at the speed of light, and it's just this tiny little thing. It takes no time at all.
But yeah, you would say if the same thing happens in the black hole, then you have all this small stuff crashing towards the singularity. Then what does the singularity does with this? Can it kick them out again, or where is it kept? I'm not saying I have an answer. I'm just saying what.
If we sit at infinity, what is it we're seeing?
Sorry.
If we just sit near infinity.
Yeah, but the question then would be if.
More radiation coming out, or are you finding we don't see anything, and nevertheless, the unitarity gets restored?
Right.
That's the model,
right?
That's the question whether this can happen, and you need a lot of degrees of freedom at very short length scale to do this, such that you can encode it in there. But I'm not saying this is a definite
this
model.
In case you can encode it in vacuum fluctuation, so it doesn't cost you any energy.
Perhaps because Rob is on page 10 of 18.
That's fine. I have, how much time do I have left? I have the analogs, but I think
yeah,
I can skip. I can skip this.
How much would you need?
No, I think this is the second part about these analogs, but I think there's no problem to skip this and right away come to the summary. Oh yeah, here, that is very important. This is our paper over there where many of the details can be found. And so here I discussed in general a few examples for quantum radiation and shows you that in all these cases, or explain why we say that in all these cases you have produced particles in pairs, which can be understood nicely with this two harmonic oscillators picture. And then I showed you how, if you have one of them, then what would be the other guy, the partner over there, how to make this notion precise. And I gave you an example for the moving mirror case, which was over here, and for the black hole case, how given a Hawking particle over here, what the partner would look like. And the result we seem to be getting is that in the moving mirror case, the partner is exactly a vacuum fluctuation locally. And in black hole case, it's approximately, not exactly, but sort of approximately a vacuum fluctuation. And what this tells us is that a very naive identification between information or correlation or entropy with energy is very, very dangerous. So we should be very careful. And I talked a little bit about the black hole information puzzle, and I had to skip the lab analogs, but you already heard about them earlier. And now let me do the last thing. So then congratulations to Bill. I think this picture was from the last fest, where later on we had a little birthday cake. And then the best wishes for Bill. And thank you for your attention.
I just wanted to clarify something. So in the black hole case, the Hawking particles are the ones that go to infinity, and the partners are the ones that go to the black hole.
Yes. Oops. Yeah.
Okay, I would have thought that it's the Hawking particle that moves along the horizon, and it's the other one that gets reflected. That it's the analog of the one that falls in the black hole.
No. I mean, this is like look. You have a one-dimensional black hole, and you have this moving this little point-like mirror, and you let it drop down to the black hole. So the Hawking radiation is then the stuff where things are reflected by this mirror and then come back to you. That's the Hawking radiation.
It depends on whether you look in the past or the future.
Which
is analogous to
that. Yeah.
Because in the bottom, the partner is on the outside.
I mean, here, this is all vacuum. I mean, here. And so only this part of the vacuum is then later converted to Hawking. The mirror is falling into the black hole.
Because the mirror, mirror inverts left and right, so just invert left and right down at the bottom, and you're fine.
Maybe you can show it in that field, then it's going to be.
No, at the bottom. At the bottom.
There is a point there, a special point where the horizon is sort of.
That's where it merges. Yeah.
This point is it 25?
So this where the event horizon starts. I mean, once you have an event horizon, then this is well defined. That assumes that the black hole is there forever. I mean, then you have an event horizon, and that's in principle well defined where it starts. Yeah. I mean, I think what you want to do to. Okay, you can also do the R equals zero with the mirror, but I think here with this mirror, I find it most easy to imagine you have the black hole down there, you have this point like mirror, and you let it just drop down. And then what you see is this mirror moving into the black hole, and vacuum coming past you is reflected off the mirror and reaches you, and you see the thermal radiation. That's sort of what is here.
I think left-right symmetry is not one of the most crucial features of this analogy.
Yeah, if your black hole evaporates in your mirror model, I guess that would be coming back to vertical, accelerating or something like that, then the partner will eventually reflect off something, whether that's a curved part or a straight part, and then the detector mode will be entangled with the partner mode. And is that similar to early versus late radiation entanglement that we want?
If you would, you could imagine that the sort of a one model for an evaporating black hole would then be that the mirror sort of stops accelerating, and then after a while slowly comes to a rest until finally it's at rest again.
Well, and then there's the inside and outside.
Out, and then, but
later on, once the black hole evaporates, it just becomes two different parts, early and late radiation.
I think
it's kind of the same mode, because the partner here is
locked
in, you can't access it, right?
No, you can.
Yeah, if it stops, I mean, the most simple thing is to say, okay, after a long time, it just stops accelerating and goes off with a constant velocity. And then all these partner modes eventually would, after it stops accelerating, would see the mirror, but it would be an inertial mirror, and it would be reflected off this inertial mirror as vacuum going this way. And then you would have entanglement between thermal stuff here and then vacuum way, way over there, but still vacuum, if it's inertial. If it then sort of slows down, then you produce again something, and then it's no longer vacuum. And then you have to ask the question, yeah, how can you slow it down that you don't produce a lot and so on, and then you need a huge time, but yeah. But this is more like the picture, if this mirror is more, say, R equals zero, what Benny was telling, then you would do this. Here it's really, I just take one mirror and just let it fall down. That's sort of what's behind this.
I'm trying to understand what's being claimed. So this is just a pure quantum field theory in flat space with a boundary.
Yes.
Calculation.
Yeah.
And you're claiming you can choose the trajectory of the mirror in such a way that at early times you see something very similar to Hawking radiation for as long as you like. And then at early times you don't see anything particularly.
Yeah, if that would be if you stop accelerating after some time, yeah.
And how long is this late time? How long do you have to give the mirror to slow down?
No, I mean, there's one thing that you see. No, initially, yeah, that can be basically immediately. That doesn't, so you have, it starts accelerating, and then say here it becomes inertial, almost the speed of light. Then you have the thermal stuff coming out, and here is basically vacuum, and here's a little bit of, but if you smooth this out, this is tiny. So then here, the stuff here will eventually reach the mirror and be reflected as vacuum. If you want to do this, then you have to accept, or it's non-inertial, and then you produce again stuff. So I'm not sure which one you want, but if you just stop accelerating, yeah, then here you have, this is just inertial mirror, and things are reflected.
Since you know how to do Lorentz transformations, that's the same as going up.
Yeah, just it is. Yeah, an inertial mirror would reflect vacuum to vacuum.
It seems like you have a violation of the subadditivity or whatever the word is. You have a lot of entanglement between the talking mode and late-time vacuum.
Yeah, yes.
But the vacuum modes, they should have been entangled with other vacuum modes.
No, the partner mode, I mean, this is not all the vacuum. We are just looking at special modes, and this mode is only entangled with this mode and with nothing else. So this Hawking mode here is only entangled with this special mode there.
It's being entangled with the nearby mode.
No.
And that would generally disrupt the vacuum.
Sorry. No.
Yeah,
sure, between points, but we are not talking about points. I have one special Hawking mode here, and I can tell you which partner mode is there such that the combined state of these two modes, just two modes, is pure.
Yeah,
but if it was completely the vacuum, that mode up in the region you've labeled vacuum wouldn't have been entangled with the Hawking mode down there. So why not? If everything was vacuum, then that mode there would have been entangled with something down here.
Yeah.
With another vacuum bit down here.
Yeah. I mean, just if you just trace them back, they're just two modes quite close to each other, and they are entangled.
You take his partner that he's entangled with. Now you replace everything before that point where it went straight by vacuum again, with all the usual vacuum entanglements, then you would have found that this guy up here was entangled with other vacuum fluctuations back in the past.
I don't think the guy up there is strongly entangled with the vacuum fluctuations in the past.
Why? That's the way the vacuum works. It has entanglement.
I mean, yeah, the point is,
these totally agree it has entanglement all over the place.
And this is one of the all over the place.
So if you could certainly, in principle, if you want, decompose, write the out state as some Fock space state with all, particle modes. And I can't imagine, so look at all the modes going to right null infinity. Is that a mixed state or is that a pure state?
No, that would be pure. I mean, here this is all, this is...
Okay, but I mean, now if you write it as a particle state, I mean, you're clearly going to have Hawking particles and they've got to be entangled with some other particles.
No, with modes. They are entangled with modes.
The mode structure that you apply to that in the place where you have, you know, thermal case, you change your mode basis such that you have usual quantum radiation, whereas they're still entangled with the mode functions that you have in the
saying if you write it as a Fock space state, as a mode Fock space, I've been fighting against people doing this because I think it's a bad way to think about quantum field theory normally, but in this particular instance, you should have fucked yourself. Understand better what's going on. I'm not talking now about any field correlations, which I would normally be doing that. I just want to know what is the out Fock space state. And I don't see how you could write an out Fock space state without having some particle modes that would correspond to these partner modes reflecting off the mirror. And if you have those modes, then I will go back and throw away the S matrix and say that I don't think the state near infinity or near the, where in this region that you just drew that's labeled back, I think will have some distinguishability from locally from the vacuum state. It may have very little energy, it may be, you know, but there's got to be a way of writing the out Fock space state as a, you know, particle state, and that's going
The point is, what I'm saying here, this is approximate. I mean, it's not the partner mode here, you can calculate it, you write down it, but it's only approximately given by the perfect mirror image there. Yeah. So if you say the Hawking mode is totally has a compact spatial support there, then the Hawking the partner mode here will be only approximately the mirror image, but it will also have spatial support in general over here. So it will exponentially small, whatever, but reach in the whole regime. And maybe this is sort of that you cannot simply split them up. They all have sort of these tails.
Can you say there's
an important point here. And that is the mode that's the partner. You've got to distinguish between modes and particles. Mm-hmm. Remember, we've been battling this for 40 years. The mode that is the partner mode is not a pure negative frequency mode as far as up in that place in terms of the usual modes. So it's got both positive and negative frequencies in it. Mm-hmm. But if you take that mode, and you make any measurements you want on it, all of the results will be the same as if you did those measurements in the vacuum. That's what the claim is. So you have some way of measuring that mode, and you can measure modes which have positive and negative. You know, switch on a detector suddenly and switch it off, that measures a mode which has got both positive and negative frequencies in it. Actually positive and negative norm, but anyway. So you can measure these guys and so forth, and all measurements you'll make on it will be precisely what you get in the vacuum. So
I could be, but you're incorrect in saying that if you did this particle analysis, you'd find particles coming out, so to speak, in this description. Well, those particles, I don't know when they would exactly be coming out. But the statement might still it still could conceivably be true. That would be really quite interesting. If you know the restriction of that state to the region we're talking about, this sort of late after the Hawking radiation is done with the inertial mirror, the restriction of that state there could be indistinguishable from the vacuum state. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yes.
I guess I don't have a real airtight argument against that. We have to think about that.
Then I thought your argument was pretty evident.
But I don't know that. I don't know that. You know, various particle states couldn't be indistinguishable from the vacuum state in local regions. Globally, obviously, there.
Did you say you calculated the stress energy tensor up there, or are you just saying
it's no? But I mean, you can. Okay, we have the 2-point function here. That's all no problem. And the 2-point function of the v modes going in this way, they're obviously just ln v minus v prime. So there's exactly 2-point function of these v modes going this way is exactly the same as vacuum. I mean, right. Of course, since they didn't see the mirror at all, they are just going this way. Yeah. And then you can calculate the energy momentum tensor from this.
It's the correlations between the different.
Yeah, okay, correlations between here and there. That then looks different. Correlations.
Right, what about correlations between modes that are localized up
in the thermal region?
In what's labeled as the vacuum region there.
Right, two-point correlation function there. And all the 2-point functions, including its Hadamard singularities and everything, are exactly what you would calculate in the vacuum.
I mean, here you would.
Therefore, the point split stress energy tensor is the same.
So,
in principle, I mean, we are discussing this. But perhaps we should maybe the general discussion session, so there are now various options. More questions to specific talks, a general question, or since it was complaining so much yesterday about conference summary.
I will not do a conference.
Or maybe, I mean, I don't know. Okay, fine. I was just saying, yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.